This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
We in Britain run institutions where narcotic use is rife.
Drugs is a massive trade. If you have drugs, effectively you have money. Drugs is majorly influential. It's the most influential resource that people have inside there.
And where violence is taken for granted.
If you're a gangster or you're involved in a sort of street culture, one way or another, you're going to normally end up in prison. And you're going to obviously meet with people that you don't have a good rapport with. So in that instance there, you have loads of gang violence. Just happens, really.
And it's happening more. Step with me into the briefing room to discover why we are losing control of our prisons. I'll be briefed by a group of experts who have experience of prison or knowledge of prison policy. But first, listen to Charles, recently released from a Category B prison, who I spoke to earlier.
Immediately after you're sentenced, you'd be cuffed and taken downstairs to like a holding dock. From there, you're transported to the prison alongside other prisoners on the bus. And there, you're taken to like a sort of induction wing. Anyone who's coming into that prison will all be held in like a reception area. And then after that, you join the wing the following day.
And then what?
Okay, so that's where the movies become that little bit real. So you do walk into a really kind of cold, empty sort of environment. That's what you call the wing. You've got cells to either your sides, and it's maybe got four floors or something of that sort there, and metal railings and so on and so forth. And it's like, it's really manic. Because when you first arrive there, sometimes you might come during something called association. That's when everyone's out and about doing their bits and bobs, showering, getting their food, this, that, and the other. Whatever you might be doing, just kind of socialising with all the other prisoners in the vicinity. Or sometimes, if you're lucky, you might come out when it's really quiet. You can kind of get taken to your cell, and you just find out where it is you're going to be living for the next few months. Or years, depending on your sentence, really.
And where do you sleep?
In your cell.
What's the night? Cell.
It depends. If you're lucky, you might have a single cell, which is highly unlikely. Initially, you'd go to a double cell, and that's just a generic single room with a bunk bed and a toilet inside it.
How clean is the place?
Yeah, it's below standard. It's ridiculous. But it's understandable at the same time, because you've got people all put in one environment that has different mental states and different levels of cleanliness and so on and so forth. So the state of it is absolutely rancid. It's ridiculous. But after a while, you kind of learn that it dawns on you that you can't change anything, and you've just kind of got to get through it. And some manage to get through it and some people don't. And that's where you have things like suicides and depression and so on and so forth.
What about some of these stories we've been hearing about drugs in prison? I have no idea what spice is. Okay. I know, migrants. Tell me what happens with it.
Spice is a drug. It's like, it comes in a format, it looks like tobacco, but it's very, very, very different to it. It's mind-blowing stuff, I suppose. Some people start hallucinating, some people just pass out. I'll give you an instance of someone who's taken spice in the prison I was in, I suppose, and the guy decided to go run around naked. And what he was doing, the guy was quite athletic and very agile, so he was able to jump from landing to landing, almost like Tarzan in a weird way. And obviously the officers couldn't bring that under control. People might find it humorous, I suppose, but can never really work out how people react to it. If you took spice and I took spice, we could have two very, very, very different reactions, and it'd be doubtful to other people if we even took the same drug.
Would you say drugs in prison, are they easy to get?
Relatively easy. Because officers can turn a blind eye to it. They know things go on, but sometimes it takes too much resources to get to the bottom of it. People turn a blind eye to things a lot of the time.
You think you saw that happen?
I think so, yeah, definitely, yeah. Yeah. And again, like, people, they do a great job of concealing it as well.
Now, of course, your environment in prison is, to a large extent, set by the staff.
Yeah.
Because they're the people who run it. Did you feel that they were good, that there were enough of them? Tell me about that.
Well, definitely not enough staff, but good. You couldn't really say if they're good or bad. when it comes to prison staff, in that some people are coming there for a pay packet, some people are coming there for change.
Which group was the bigger group of prison officers, in your view?
Honestly,
it'll
have to be those that came for the pay packet. Because, I mean, when I got there, I started a business course within 11 days. My cellmate arrived in the prison on the exact same day, and he started 6 weeks after. And it's just a case of, we both had asked repeatedly. I was just fortunate enough to have come across a decent officer and made a phone call.
Why did you say that you felt there weren't enough of them? How would that kind of manifest itself?
Well, if you've got a wing in the institution I was in, I think the wing had a bit, I think something about 180 prisoners on that one wing. There's to each landing, there's two members of staff. So if we'd done the maths on it and we said there's 45 people per landing and there's two members of staff and it's a prison, well, you do the math. If something were to obviously go south, maybe territorial issues are going on and five guys are having an altercation with one fella, what could they really do in such an instance? If you're waiting for maybe a minute or 2 minutes for staff to kind of bring the situation under control, you can imagine what could have happened.
Frustration, psychosis, blind eyes, dirt, drugs, and above all, the hugely variable and all-important relationship between the prisoners and the overstretched prison staff. One man's view of life in prison. Well, here with me in the briefing room to discuss what's happening in our prisons and why it matters are John Podmore, former prison governor at Brixton and Belmarsh and former head of the Prison Services Anti-Corruption Unit, Julian McRae, deputy director at the Institute for Government, and Helen Arnold, lecturer at Suffolk University and visiting scholar at the Cambridge Prison Centre. Julian, if I could start with you, why are we talking about this now? What do these statistics tell us?
Well, what we've seen recently is partly what the statistics are telling us, that prisons are becoming more violent and less safe environments, but it's also what the newspapers have been telling us. There have been a series of stories over the last few months which have shown prisoners escaping from very secure prisons, something that we generally don't see actually in the UK. We've been very good at preventing escapes for a very long time. We also saw the prison officers and the prison governors highlighting that the environment had just become unsafe for them, for prisoners. And the statistics on that, if you look back about 18 months, it's been pretty clear that those statistics are showing an increase and a continuing increase over that period. Now, this a lot of people think is related to what happened if you go back even a little bit further in history, back to 2010. Big spending review, we were cutting public spending across a lot of areas. Prisons was one of those areas. That played out in a reduction in staff numbers. You see quite big drops up to about 2012. You see another set of big drops up to about 2014. And a sense now that maybe we went too far on that, that actually the level of security and control inside prisons, it's beyond our capability to run them as safe environments at the moment with that few prison officers.
What can we say about the statistics about instances of trouble, violence, deaths and so on?
So if you look at some of the key statistics, so assaults on staff, since about May 2014, that's gone up by around 60%. 60%. You'll see other statistics inside that. So assaults of prisoners on prisoners have gone up, not quite as much, but very steeply over that period. If you look at deaths in custody, self-inflicted death, suicides, up by around 60% over that period.
Another 60.
So these are very, very clear and been clear for quite a long time. And a lot of people have actually been saying it for quite a long time. You know, we are pushing our prisons under the current regime beyond the point at which they seem safe. Now, actually, the politics of this is actually a fascinating one. People tend not to be too concerned about the welfare of prisoners in general politics. It's not like hospitals or schools where you're concerned about the children or you're concerned about the patients. Prisons are obviously very different. But governments tend to be very concerned about seeming to be in control of prisons. The public cares greatly about prisoners escaping. And that was what we saw in the last few months and why suddenly we have a situation where the Treasury has decided it's going to put some more money back into prisons. We're going to have more prison officers inside the system.
Well, we'll come back down to your rather brutal equation later, which is that we don't really mind very much if prisoners kill each other and themselves, but we rather object if they start escaping and being a threat to us. What can we say about two other key variables, which are prisoner numbers and staff numbers.
Yeah. So prisoner numbers, after a very long period before 2010 when prisoner numbers were rising and continuously rising, they've actually been relatively stable, around 85, 86,000 across that period. There was a slight peak after the London riots, up to about 88,000. But in historic terms, it's actually been a plateau in prisoner numbers. On staff numbers, we've dropped quite a bit, about 25% reduction in staff numbers.
Since
around 2010.
We have dropped 25% in staff numbers on a no reduction of prisoner numbers in the last 6 years.
That's basically what's happened. And that's how we've saved the money. You know, we've saved about 20% out of the Ministry of Justice budget over that period. When you're talking about prisons, staffing costs, they're your big issue. That's the biggest cost we have. So if you're going to reduce expenditure, you're going to be having less prison staff.
Now, I dare say, because it always happens at this kind of point, that one of the arguments that might be used is that you can't make a correlation necessarily or a causation between staff numbers and an increase in incidences. What would you say to that?
Well, look, I think staff numbers tell you something, but they're not the be-all and end-all. Who those staff are, how they're being used, what prisons you're using them in. Some of our older prisons are quite difficult to actually run securely. Newer prisons tend to be designed to be easier to run. I think, though, and you're quite right, you can't say causally something's happened here, but the timing of these changes, it looks like in the first few years we're reducing prison officer numbers, actually we were still running prisons relatively safely. Whether we were using them to rehabilitate prisoners, a whole other set of issues, is another question. But it's the latest, the second round of cuts, as it were, and reductions, which I think now most people accept almost certainly was a problem that has led to that increase in violence within prisons. There are other factors here, though. Your interview earlier was talking about drugs and changing use of drugs and all sorts of things. So it's not as simple as just put prison officers back in. It's a much more complicated world, but there's certainly something happening quite dramatically in our prison at the moment.
John Paul Moore, sticking just very much to this point of whether or not things are seen to be getting worse, we've heard some of the statistics, but is it your impression that things are getting worse?
I mean, no doubt. I mean, the prison system is in crisis, and I think, generally speaking, things are getting worse. I mean, I spent sort of 25 years in the system, and to hear of a homicide, I mean, I can't really think over 25 years of any incidences of homicide. There might have been one or two. Now we're talking about the rates of homicide per year. And, you know, we can talk how we got here. And I think there was political interference. I think National Offender Management Service shooting itself in the foot, issues around privatisation. But the system is in crisis, and then something needs to be done very quickly.
Now, one of the things which Charles certainly zeroed in on, and we've talked about it a bit, is the question of staffing being the major cost. Helen Arnold, you trained as a prison officer as part of your PhD. Did you find it a difficult job?
Absolutely, yeah. I think people underestimate the complexity of the job and how specialised it is, in the sense that you have to do such a number of different roles and tasks throughout any day. You don't know what you're going to be faced with. It's unpredictable. And trying to do things like establish relationships with prisoners without getting too close, so learning where to kind of draw the line, where the boundaries are in terms of kind of caring about them but not caring for them, distinguishing between what you think is the right way to treat people, but also being aware of the fact that there are a number of rules that you're supposed to abide by at the same time that aren't always enforceable.
Now, Charles talked to us about, and he was very clear about this sort of two types of prison officer. I dare say he would have allowed that there were gradations of them. Did you discover that? And is that borne out by your research?
I think what was borne out from the research was that there are different types of officers. There are some that have more of a focus on the kind of order and control, but you also had other officers that had a more kind of caring orientation, a more kind of feeling that they're also there to support prisoners. But it took a kind of a whole mixture of staff to actually make it work.
Did you find some prison officers there who were useless, who just didn't care very much, were not very good at their jobs?
I have come across prison officers like that, but it's a rare thing. I think it's also important to understand why they may be feeling like that. So I don't think it's because inherently they don't care. I think it's normally because they are feeling either too much pressure. So it's then very easy for officers to kind of resort to what they know best, and what they feel they know best is security. So they will kind of withdraw a little bit from relationships if they don't feel confident in having them, if they don't feel supported by managers.
So actually, you would anticipate that given the funding since 2010, actually that would result in more pressure on them and they would be less good at their jobs?
It would result in them having more to do with less time. So, for example, then prisoners may feel the impact of that in the sense that their requests and applications may not be dealt with as quick as they wish them to. It might mean that an officer would be struggling to provide an extra phone call, say, because they know a prisoner's upset about something. So those kinds of signals of care and respect and fairness may go out of the window for prisoners, and staff will just feel that they don't have the time or the support to be able to carry out those parts of their job.
So tell me, how important is it that they would feel that way? Another way of putting this is, how central is that relationship between the prisoner and the member of staff to the prison experience, to what actually happens and the consequences?
It's absolutely vital. Prisons run on relationships between staff and prisoners, there's no doubt about it. Without the right kind of relationships between staff and prisoners, then I think that's where you start to see a lot of failings.
Jim McRae, can we come back to some of the statistics on this? There was one thing that really struck me, which was the difficulty of retaining prison officers even once you'd recruited them. Could you take me through that?
Right. Well, recruitment and retention are always the big things you're looking at in any workforce. And what's happened with prison officers, one of the ways we've been saving money, obviously there are sort of questions about, as we recruit in new people, can we retain them? Do we get high levels of people coming in, doing a job for a reasonably short time and moving on? And what's happening to our experience? So do you end up with a workforce that is as good as the one you had to start with? And those are really, really big questions.
They are. So what's the answer?
Well, the answer at the moment is that actually it looks like we're having problems retaining people because the job is becoming more stressful. Now, you know, where's that going to take us? What do we do about that? A lot of this will be about how do you get people working in a prison environment, focusing on the things you really want them focused on. So not worrying too much, you know, safety and security is essential, but can you get them, you talked about it earlier, going that extra yard and thinking about as people, how do we make this prison work? Prisons vary enormously, like any part of the world. Some are doing really well. Some are in, I think John's right, in crisis, I think is probably the word.
Well, John, so let me just get this absolutely clear so that I can. I mean, since March 2010, there's been a reduction of 6,335 full-time equivalent frontline prison officers. I mean, with your experience, John, how would that impact itself upon the sorts of people that you were leading and working with?
Well, there's all sorts of implications. And firstly, the people who go initially tend to be the more experienced ones because they're the ones who are willing to go because it's civil service, there are pensions, there are voluntary redundancy packages, and I took one myself. And the experience levels go, but also I think confidence can go. It works with staff having confidence in themselves and who's leading them, and there are issues for prisoners being confident because prisoners want to be safe, staff want to be safe, and it's about the relationships and about how the two groups work together. And I think what's caused a lot of the problems we've got at the moment is a chasm opened up in the staff-prisoner relationships. You've got prisoners who don't feel safe, and for prison officers, they're not sure who they're working for. Governors turning around very, very rapidly. And in that kind of environment, that chasm opens up and the cooperation that is essential to running a safe prison begins to fall apart. And I think that's why we are where we are now.
You weren't just a prison governor. You were head of anti-corruption at the prison service until 2011.
Yeah.
Is corruption a growing problem, do you think?
We don't know. Is it a problem? People used to say to me, how many corrupt staff are there? I didn't know. I was keen to try and find out. I don't think you'll ever know.
Of course, and as just to stress, we're not talking about all, most substantial proportion, but we're talking about some.
Some and a small minority. But with corruption, they are reluctant to acknowledge that there's a problem because, you know, it couldn't happen in prison. Well, yes, it will for a whole variety of reasons. One, drugs in prison is a multi-million pound enterprise. There are people inside and outside making a lot of money.
How does it work?
Well, there are various ways in which drugs can come in prison. Drones is kind of we're very hysterical about at the moment, and I think 33 instances of drones in the last 12 months shows we need to look at that in context. They will come over the wall. They will come in packages through the stores. Some will be smuggled in by visitors, but I'm afraid in terms of volume and quantity. In my experience, 25 years of running prisons, the biggest drug find I ever had was strapped to the legs of a prison officer. Now, this was an individual who we had suspected for a while. We did the classic sting. We caught him bang to rights with he could barely walk for the amount of drugs that was on him. He was arrested by the police. The police took him away. I thought that was a good result for us, except the police phoned me up the following day and said, we have some bad news for you. This particular prison officer had been a prisoner in Wormwood Scrubs some 3 years ago. My initial question was, well, how did he get through the checks? And that was for another date. Phone call the following day, not only was this man a prisoner 3 years previously, he was also an illegal immigrant. And the headline in The Sun the following day was, Brixton employs asylum-seeking thief. And I got the usual kind of questions from my lords and masters in headquarters. I mean, there will be staff who will join for purpose. There will be people who will join the prison service because they want to deal drugs and can make a lot of money out of it. And that's the kind of the easy bit. What we tend to forget is that there are prison officers who are doing a very difficult job with not a lot of training, with various degrees of supervision, who will be conditioned and manipulated in difficult circumstances. Because you have to look at how corruption starts. And it doesn't start with, you know, here's 100 quid, bring me in some cannabis. It starts with, I've run out of shower gel. Can you bring me in an extra bar of soap or or can you post this letter for me? And then it runs on from there. And that's about staff being, to a certain extent, not sufficiently trained in anti-corruption techniques. And then you're hooked. Mm. And then you're only corrupted once.
One of the things that we did talk about earlier was the fact that prisoner numbers were plateaued when we had actually expected them to go down. I mean, there's been an awful lot of talk about trying to get them down. Why do you think that's happening?
Well, we need to be very careful here. That there are two debates. There's a debate around sentencing reform. That's about fewer mandatory sentences, fewer life sentences. We have 11,000, 15% of our prison population are serving some form of life sentence, which is more than most of Europe combined. So we are sentencing more and more people to longer and longer, and we need to deal with this. And the good old IPP, the indeterminate sentence for public protection, you know, David Blunkett's invention, which even he says now he wish he hadn't done, you know, that's caused a lot of problems. But at the other end, what the prison system is all about is not just people coming, it's about getting people out. Now, most sentences have some flexible component, and we think of parole, we think of home detention curfew. Now, the parole board until relatively recently have been significantly under-resourced. They're now coming back up to the level that they need, and they are beginning to catch up on the backlog. So if you haven't got a properly functioning parole system, and I'm not saying you should release people that are inappropriate if you release people safely, but the parole board need the opportunity to make that decision. But in order to make that decision, it needs a prison service that is preparing prisoners for the parole process, potentially get out early, by having a decent regime where they're addressing their offending problems.
Helen, when you have a situation whereby you are less likely than maybe people in the past to get parole or to get earlier release, is it perceptible that this has an influence on prisoner psychology?
From the research that I've conducted in high security prisons, I would say that it has quite a big impact on the culture within the prison, in the sense that when I was there doing some research, you had a lot of young males serving very long sentences, life sentences for very serious offences, and were struggling to come to terms with that fact.
Crudely, would that feeling actually lead to people being more violent?
There was some narrative within the prison amongst prisoners and some staff where there was an assumption that for some of these prisoners, they've got nothing to lose. So some of the normal ways in which you would try to get prisoners to comply with the regime and behave through incentives and earn privileges had kind of lost its power somehow in the minds of those within that prison. So prisoners were kind of could say to us things like, well, you know, I'm already in the highest security conditions, I'm already doing 40 years. But I don't think that that was an incentive to violence. I think it was a way of rationalising it or justifying it. I think that there was a lot of other pressures that were being exerted upon them that meant that they acted out their frustrations and anger.
Jimmy, I'm struck by the fact that we were supposed to be digging into some of these problems. We had Michael Gove as the Minister of Justice, albeit for only a year, but it set a very kind of clear path, which was, he said, we must get a lot of these people out of prison and so on. We've got to deal with the sentencing policies. We need a kind of a fundamental change of thinking. Yet here we are. Did I get it wrong? Did I not understand?
Well, I think reform in prisons has always been one of these very difficult things. And you're quite right, Michael Gove was pushing very hard in a particular direction. He'd basically come to the conclusion that there were just too many people in prisons. And, you know, that's quite a difficult political position. He'd come from a particular place in the Conservative Party. But Ken Clark had tried to do some sentencing reform, actually relatively minor sentencing reform, back in 2010 when he was Justice Secretary. That came unstuck. It was one of the first things to come unstuck after that spending review. The Prime Minister decided that sentencing reform was just too tough politically.
I suppose what I'm asking really is, this is all fairly predictable. Create these circumstances, you get these problems. So why are we here, Julian?
Well, I think there's two sort of sides of it. One, I think the ministry itself would sort of say, look, actually, some of the earlier reforms we did actually take some cost out and not make the prison system unrunnable. I think what happened was we missed a turning point. We had one period of reform which needed to change. It needed to become more sophisticated. Some of the things John was talking about earlier about how you actually work with prisoners in a much more intense way. And we didn't get that right. We kept going with prison officer reductions. And it became clear that we needed to reverse some of that. Now, the politics of that was quite fascinating. This is the first time the Treasury has really put a large sum of money back into a department in response to an obvious problem with performance. And it was because it was the newspaper headlines. Now, we have an issue with prison reform, sentencing reform, these wider sort of things, that the politics seldom works. There's this sort of sense that, and it's politics in a very short-term sense. So it's the politics in the newspaper headline sense. I think when you get a discussion like this, where people are actually talking about prisoners as real people, and we could describe them in various other parts of the public sector, we talk about them as drug users, or we talk about them as people who were really failed by the education system. And when you start to talk about things in those terms, you get a more nuanced discussion, then it starts to open up some of the politics that allows you to think about, OK, how do we reduce the population in prisons by sorting out people's lives, not because we want to let people off in some way for the punishment for the crimes they've committed. But that really does take a lot of political drive. And, you know, for new Prime Minister and Liz Truss, Michael Gove's successor as Minister for Justice, that's something they're going to have to face because they've got a spending settlement that's going to force them to essentially do something about the amount of people in prison.
Thank you very much. That's it from the Briefing Room this week. My thanks to Charles, who you heard earlier, and thanks to the charity Key for Life for helping to arrange that interview with Charles. He's been working with the charity's education programme since he served his sentence. And my thanks too to my other guest, John Podmore, who was the former prisoner governor at Brixton and Belmarsh, to Julie McRae, deputy director at the Institute for Government, and to Helen Arnold, lecturer at Suffolk University and visiting scholar at the Cambridge Prison Centre. Till next week, goodbye. Thanks for listening to the Briefing Room podcast. If you'd like to let us know what you think of this series, there's an easy way to do it. Just give a rating or leave a review on iTunes or your podcast provider. We look forward to reading your comments.
Hello. Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.